You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
And good morning. Good morning. Marjorie Moore here to wake you up and get you going. We're going to have another great morning together. Barbara Ann Teer, who is the founder and director of the National Black Theater, will be on the phone with us for a little bit this morning to talk about a real estate problem going on there in Harlem. There are many real estate problems these days, one being efforts to move everybody out of Harlem who is not considered wealthy. We're going to get to that and much, much more here at Sunrise. It is 6:02, and you're listening to the Station of Note, WBAI 99.5 FM, and we'll be back in a minute. All right. Now, that should have you moving around, significantly moving around. Good morning. Marjorie Moore here. The show is Sunrise, heard on WBAI Radio 5 days a week. That's Monday through Friday from 6 till 7:30 a.m. And it is Thursday, January 10th, 2002. It's lovely out today. It is just lovely out. It's chilly but warm in a funny kind of a way. So you'll be pleasantly surprised, I think. All right, so get moving so we can get on with the show. We have an exciting show today, and I'm anxious to get to it. But we'll just give you a little bit more to roll over and open those eyes and wiggle the toes and kiss the one next to you and tell them you love them. should be going by now, okay, at 6:16 this Thursday morning. And again, the show is Sunrise, and we're here to get you up, get you going, and we try to effectively walk that thin line between the political and the spiritual here. So we do a lot. There is a nexus to be dealt with there, and we try to get on it. And this morning, in behalf of that effort, we have a very special person on the line with us, and that's Dr. Barbara Ann Teer, who is the founder and director of the National Black Theater, located in Harlem. Dr. Teer, are you there? Almost, she's there. Almost. Okay, we'll hang on a second. And T-Dub is engineering for us this morning, and we're going to be right there in a second. It's 6:17 in the morning. Stay tuned. Here she is. Okay, great. Dr. Teer? Good morning. Are you hearing us? Hello?
I'm hearing you fine.
Oh, great.
Are you hearing me?
I hear you now.
Oh, great.
And thank you for being here this morning.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yes, ma'am. And we'll let them know you're going to be back on Monday as well.
Very good.
We have some situations there at the National Black Theater. Well, first, could you just tell people what the National Black Theater is, Dr. Teer?
Well, before I even say that, I want to thank you and WBAI, Marjorie, for being so supportive of this time. And I noticed we talked a few minutes this morning about the crisis that you're having,
mm-hmm.
and we're also having a crisis. But you know what?
Mm-hmm.
We feel very strongly that crisis precedes transformation.
That's right.
So we know that we're in a new age, and we know that this is a transformational part. We are actually been on the corner of 125th Street and 5th Avenue for the last 33 years.
Mm-hmm.
The National Black Theater is an alternative learning environment, and it has done some incredible things. And right now, we're in a foreclosure stand, posture, foreclosure action. And we are not overwhelmed by this foreclosure action because, as I said, this is a new age, and it is time that we collectively come together to reorganize and restructure and take our consciousness to a higher level. So this is something that we feel, just like the fire we had back in 1983,
mm-hmm.
which allowed us to build that $10 million facility, we feel that this foreclosure action is happening so that it is something that is inspiring us, just like 911. It's a love attack. It's inspiring us to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
So that at this particular point on Monday night from 7 to 9, we have a movement which is called Culturenomics that we launched last year. And the Culturenomics movement is a marriage between culture and art and culture and business and culture and economics. And we know that our economic model does not work. So we want people to come to the National Black Theater at 2033 Fifth Avenue next Monday, every Monday, but this Monday from 7 to 9. And it's a campaign called Join the Drive to Keep Soul Alive. Your culture counts. It's a membership campaign. And we also want them to listen next Monday
mm-hmm.
to your show. And then at that point, we'll get to give more information. But the number to call today, because we have live operators standing there waiting for these call-ins, which is not going to happen today, mm-hmm.
Dr. Teer, let's slow down a minute, because there are a lot of people listening, perhaps, who do not know where the National Black Theater is located.
Oh, I thought I said it. Okay.
And let's let them know a little bit about the theater and what you do there. Because
You told me you had to...
A few minutes. But we can do that in a few minutes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So would you just tell us, for example, exactly where is it? How old is it?
Sure, I'd love to do that.
And what kinds of activities go on there?
Okay, the National Black Theater is really an institute of action arts. It's an alternative learning environment. It's on the corner, the northeast corner of 125th Street and 5th Avenue in Harlem, USA. We've been there for 33 years through a major fire and now through a foreclosure action that we are going through. And that's why the support is so important. We have many, many activities and programmatic activities, but one thing that's so important is that we built a brand new facility in 1983 after a major fire. And that fire, again, was the spirit giving us an opportunity to transform our consciousness to a higher level. So we are owners. We are the stand for self-empowerment, ownership, and economic mm-hmm. autonomy. Mm-hmm. And so with that, on Monday nights, that's why I told them to come and discover more about the National Black Theater, mm-hmm. to discover more about our programs, to mm-hmm. join the drive to keep soul alive, because everybody knows that Harlem is going through what some people say is a second renaissance. I happen to think that that's not so, but then that's just my opinion.
Dr. Teer, why are you in foreclosure?
Well, that's the whole reason I want to talk to people mm-hmm. about. I don't really know. I mean, the standard practice answer would be because we didn't pay a mortgage.
Right.
But that's not, I mean, that is true on one level, but everything happens for a reason. And I would tell you that this is a strong point that you're asking me, and I really would like to have more time to talk about that mm-hmm. because why we're in foreclosure, it depends on which interpretation you're coming from. I say the one that I'm choosing to come from is because this is a place that we need to be in so that we can mobilize the people, so that we can organize the masses of people, so that we can create a mass movement of self-empowerment, a mass movement of culturenomics, a mass movement of coming together, because we are kind of like in limbo right now as a people. We are being taken over here in Harlem, all the small businesses, the local businesses, the black theaters across the country are closing down rapidly. And most people don't understand that culture is the most important, the most vital context that you can have, because that's where our value is. If you don't have a culture that teaches you self-worth and self-love, and that gives you a sense of value of who you are, then naturally people will take over you.
Dr. Teer, are you, I know that at one point I did several shows about the Harlem Mart on 125th Street.
Yes.
And they lost their battle
exactly.
with the city. Is there an organization bringing all of you together who seem to be under attack for your space in Harlem?
The organization right now, I'm declaring on your radio show, is
right.
the National Black Theater.
Okay, you're forming one.
Yes.
And if people come Monday night, they can begin to pursue this even further.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's a good point. And then the other thing is, what in your mind is what is the greatest contributing factor to this assault on space in Harlem? Where is it? Why are
our
you protected
lack of
at
unity.
This point?
Our lack of unity.
Mm-hmm. Are your elected officials working with you?
Well, yes and yes and no and yes and no.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem here is that we do not ask enough
mm-hmm.
for enough money. We would never fund it correctly. But, you know, we get so excited when something happens that's going to move our people forward, so we don't deal with the details, with the fine print, because there's a story here that's very profound. But, yes, our elected officials are supporting us. And yes, they could support us with a deeper kind of energy, but that's because we as a people, the masses of people, the culturally conscious people who understand the power of our culture as a healing force, we must come together and we must make the stand. This is a strong point that our unity is what's going to make our mm-hmm. Elected officials.
And what is it you need specifically, Dr. Teer, to get the wolf away from the door?
You know, we need to raise money, which
okay.
is why we have a membership campaign, $65.
Mm-hmm.
We want this to come from the people. Mm-hmm. We want this to be about bringing the people together, because it's the unity that is going to codify our culture. Because even if we raise millions of dollars, which is necessary,
mm-hmm.
and we are calling forth money. We want people to give money toward the National Black Theater's membership campaign. Notice I didn't say we're doing a lot of fundraising.
Right.
And No. We want this to grow from the bottom up.
How much would you like to raise?
Well, we have to raise $9 million, but for the foreclosure, we only need $2.7 million.
Mm-hmm. Are you near it? Are you...
We're always near it every day. As I speak, we're near it. You know, there is always the possibility of a phone call or somebody you walk down the street. You know, I'm very much grounded in spiritual universal principles, mm-hmm. as above, so below. And so I don't take this like this is not panicking me. I'm not going to fall over and die. I've been there for 33 years with no break. I'm telling you that you never know what this is going to create. I think it should create the movement. I'm not overwhelmed by this. I've been baptized by a fire, a five-alarm fire. Now I'm being baptized by a foreclosure. Everything that happens is inspired by the spirit of love.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, we're calling forth the love that is housed inside each person that's listening to you to save themselves, to love themselves, to value themselves, and to show it in the form of coming on Monday night to the National Black Theater. Now, the telephone number is very important because the people are waiting there to talk to you personally since we had to do this so fast, Marjorie.
Mm-hmm.
And the number is, if I may give it right now, 722-3800. That's a 212 area code, of course.
722-3800.
And if they call at 9 or from 9 on, they will get a live operator that can discuss with them what's going to happen every Monday night, what's going to happen to the National Black Theater, what are we doing now, discover what they can do to support it even greater than the $65 on the membership campaign.
So it's an activity that will take place every Monday evening.
Yes.
At what time?
7 o'clock.
All right. And it begins this Monday.
It's been going on for a long time, but we had a break during the holidays. But it begins this Monday at 7 o'clock.
All right.
From 7 to 9. And they can call at 9, the National Black Theater, 722-3800.
Great.
722-3800.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll get to talk to a live operator who can tell them more about the details. Am I going to be on your show next Monday?
So Monday morning, you're going to come back, and you are going to talk a little further about your activities.
And then I can slow down.
Yeah.
And I don't have to say that if I don't say it all quick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I want people to really understand what's going on here.
All right, and we'll get into it, to the meat of it. So
that'll be wonderful.
Okay, Dr. Tier. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You're welcome, and we really are interested in covering these issues where our institutions are being threatened.
Oh,
it's so hard to get in.
They're being closed down.
It's so hard to build them. Then once you begin to build them and then have them removed, it's.
But there's things we can do about that, Mark. Mm-hmm. I think it's happening on purpose.
Yeah.
And I think that this radio show that you have is so wonderful because it gives us an opportunity for people to at least smell that something is going on, that they need to rise up to a higher level of consciousness and get stronger in their resolve to be on the planet.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for your work and your efforts there. And I hope people will call that number, 212-722-3800, and find out how you can help the National Black Theater. Do that, 212-722-3800. Thank you, Dr. Barbara Antier. You're welcome, and we will talk again on Monday.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM, your Pacifica station in New York City. I'm Marjorie Moore here with you, waking you up, getting you going, keeping you informed, and we'll be right back.
The octahedron and and the icosahedron and the cube. However, if you do not comprehend my lingo vibration, then let me overthink and break it down a second time. I mean plasma, gas, liquid, and solid. Now if you can't interbios and relate, then in simple terms, I am fire, air, water, and earth. Intuition of cause and effect generates my thinking into feeling your sensation. Oh, magnificent. When I try to hate, I am duality stemming from the oneness. Now if I told you that I came from Fomlahat, Aldebaran, Regolith, and Antares, you might label me crazy house Louis. But you know, I understand the three pillars which you stand on. I know from where your tree of life stems. You are my reflection. You know, this from me, then it would only be right to say that I'm the helios, the helium, the sun, the sperm that sets through the black hole, the womb that birthed you. We are the XX, XY, the tectonic shift, the planetary drift. I know you want to kill me after these words. But I'm sincere when I say, hi, my name is Ruby, better known as Sister Flame, and I am the spark to your flame of consciousness. And might I add, you have beautiful windows to the soul of my reflection.
Stand for your culture.
The National Black Theater, after 33 years in Harlem, is determined to maintain ownership of its building. It means we have just a few days to prove to the world that we are conscious people who won't let the silent attack of numbers displace our institution, keep us from telling our stories uncensored, and providing an alternative cultural learning environment for our community. We ask you to join the drive to keep soul alive. Help sustain the National Black Theater by calling 212-926-1049. That's 212-926-1049.
This has been a public service announcement on behalf of the National Black Theater, a non-profit organization.
Hi, this is Gil Scott Heron, unknown bluesologist, speaking to you on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. Stay here.
All right, we're back. It is 6:36. Folks, are you moving around, those of you who have to get out to work or other responsibilities? It's a good day to do it. Every day is a good day. We should not wake up wanting to hold back the day. That's how I used to wake up years ago. please, Lord, hold back the day. Because I had so many issues and so much crap to take care of. But those days are over now. I embrace the day. You hear a little giggle in the background. I bet you're wondering, who is that giggling back there? That's you, Tracy Lee. Back on Sunrise.
Oh, Lord, hold back the day.
Hold back the day.
What a prayer.
Get back under the covers. Oh,
please, Lord.
Lord,
if you have any mercy, you'll hold back the day.
Day.
I like that prayer.
It didn't work, but anyway, we grew through it, you Tracy.
I tell
we grew
you.
Through it. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
And thank you so much for being here with us again.
Oh, it's a delight. It is always a delight to be with you and this fantastic audience. I love
audience.
That prayer. Yeah. Dear Lord, please, if you can, hold back the day. I ain't even ready.
No.
There are days when I really feel like that.
Oh,
it's like,
yeah.
Oh. Well, I have one eye open. Mm-hmm. I don't think I want to open the other one just yet.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And one of the things that I learned that is true about crisis is, you know, the Chinese symbol for it is the symbol for crisis is the same symbol for opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes so much sense to me now because I like to say to people, how do you do what you do? Or young people, if I speak to a group, how did you get to do what you do? How did you get to be successful? And I say, it's built on all my failures. Everything that I failed at set me in another direction.
Mm.
And if you don't give up, if you're fortified and you don't give up and you know that underneath that is something really fine trying to come through and work itself out for you, it's going to be all right.
Well, you know, that's an interesting approach because some people rigidify their lives,
mm-hmm.
And see it as the logical way to go. And it works for them. I mean, there are people
that's
who
true.
Believe, well, this is what I'll do at this point, and after that, this is where I'll go. And but my life hasn't been turning out that way.
You just show up.
My life has been, I tell you, I've been thinking about this.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's scary because you feel that life is happening to you, you know, and you're not in control. And then at another point, you say to yourself, well, wait a minute. That is a pretty silly thing to say that you're in control of something that completely eludes you. You weren't in control to be born. You're not going to be in control as to when you die. And in between, how much control could you have about what you do? I mean, the control that we have is really finite.
Mm-hmm.
But the opportunities
mm-hmm.
and the possibilities are infinite.
Mm-hmm.
For where it is we're going to go. And in my life, I don't know how it's been turning out in yours, but you pretty much gave us a clue. Life has happened to me.
Yes.
And I really didn't plan much of this.
Or maybe what happened just looks nothing like your plan.
My plan was, early on, you know, we were encouraged to start formulating in our heads where it is we were supposed to be going. And I asked around in the family, and practically, I think only two of us really kind of followed a plan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The rest of us kind of went with the flow.
Trace, you have mentioned many times on the air, I've heard you do it on Talkback as well, something very intriguing to me.
What?
You talk about when you were growing up,
yeah.
Your father used to sit you down. and what was it? Ask you your life.
What is going to be your statement in life?
Your statement in life.
Yes.
What is going to be your statement?
What is going to be your statement in life?
Did he talk further about that question and to help you formulate a response? Or he just threw that out there?
Well, the whole idea was, you know, this was part of the review. We were subjected to very close scrutiny and review. My mother, like most mothers, dispensed justice daily in the household.
Yes.
And she regulated the household from Sunday through Friday. Saturday was generally the day that we belonged to Claude, body and soul. And usually in the evening, you know, 7:30 in that area, life came to an end. I mean, you don't plan anything on Saturday because constitutional talks are scheduled. And that's when your whole week would be reviewed, your performance at school, your behavior around the house, your, you know, the little fights you might have gotten into, the ways in which you probably displeased, you know, the edicts that you violated, all of these things would be taken into account. And then there was a general thing about we were expected to know things. But then came the major portion, which was called Lessons in Life.
And you would be sitting sort of down?
No, you're not sitting. You are standing. We are standing in a long line because there are nine of us. And you're standing at attention. And you will be standing there sometimes until 1 or 2 in the morning. The only person sitting in the room is the person talking to you.
That's Claude.
Really?
That's right.
Did you protest?
You couldn't? What is the protest? What protest
Well, kids, protest.
We didn't learn. That's a recent word in my lexicon. You didn't protest. You were summoned and you stood there and you accounted for yourself and you spoke when you were spoken to. But Lessons in Life was the big one, you know, and that's where the question arose. Mm-hmm. After, you know, you've been put through the ringer on a number of other counts, then came Lessons in Life. And that's where he would talk about, in life, we have to have book sense and you have to have common sense.
Mm-hmm.
You always must have common sense. And you always must be conscious of why you are here. What is to be your statement in life? This was the big question. And we were encouraged to constantly think about this. What is to be your statement in life? It's not just what is going to be your profession.
Right.
Or what are you going to do? Or what kind of job you're going to have? That was not the question. The question is, what will you be doing? What will the sum total of your life be?
Mm-hmm.
For the time that you're here on the face of the earth, as a contributor to society, as a contributor to mankind? That's the big question.
And it was, so it wasn't meant to be answered. It was meant to be pondered.
It was meant to be pondered.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a big lecture, big time.
And so what would he say? What would be some of the things he would say?
Always be compassionate. It's not about you. You know, the world is bigger than you. And the world will be here after you're gone. The world is bigger than you. It will be here after you've gone. In a sense, if you think you're such hot stuff, I'll take you to a place where people bigger than you have gladly jumped off.
Mm-hmm.
Because life can really do you in. If you think you're really such big stuff, people bigger than you have been done in. So don't start getting any
ego
great
tripping.
Idea. Yeah, no, you're tripping.
Yeah.
It had to do about honor and a concern, always a concern about how your behavior or how your conduct affects other people.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly it's about, it ain't all about you.
Right.
And you are here for a divine purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about a job. It's not about a gig. It's not about a thing, a project, or it's not about a singular achievement for yourself. It's not, none of these things are in any way really important. You will always, you know, you can always have a job. There will always be a way for you to earn some money, and that's not why you're here.
That's right.
You're here for something far more meaningful, and that is to be your life's work. That is your life statement.
Mm. I'm just trying to picture little kids sort of, I mean, I think it's a wonderful thing to do with young children because asking you to ponder it and instilling that idea in your thought,
mm-hmm.
and then you will ponder it.
Well, you know, it wasn't just as children.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, long after some members of my family married and left home, they'd come back
mm-hmm.
for these sessions. And
was he cheerful when he did this? Or?
My father was always very... He was hysterically funny.
Mm-hmm.
Except on Saturdays. Saturdays was not a funny day. Saturdays was a kind of serious day. But our household was always very cheerful. And
mm-hmm.
very... people liked coming to our house
mm-hmm.
a lot. Because my mother was very nurturing. My father was very funny. And he was... they both were, as parents, I think. We couldn't have gotten better parents.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't have gotten better parents.
Mm-hmm. It's, in my household, we grew up hearing about the lessons all the time from a defeated father. My father was a defeated black man.
Wow.
He was a very hard... You know, I remember when we moved from Bed-Stuy when I was small,
uh-huh.
and I remember the lecture in the kitchen. I will not raise my children in the projects. I will not. And at that time, it was urban removal. They were coming in to tear down the building
yeah.
we were in, and
yeah.
and he managed to on a barber. He was a barber for a while, and he worked 3-4 jobs. He managed to get a beautiful home for us, and out in Queens, it was a beautiful thing. And he worked hard because he was very bright.
Yeah.
He wrote poetry and
oh, wow.
he would write. I always remember in his room, he's studying. Daddy, sir, we had to say sir.
Yeah, we do.
And keep yeah. that, and when he's in his room studying, you better, and there's 6 of us, you children better be quiet. And he'd be in there and he'd be writing all this stuff that he never shared with us, but he'd be expressing himself. And then he'd have to get up and go to work. And then on Saturdays, people would come into the kitchen because he cut hair.
Mm.
And he would be set up in there. And he was always working, but so terribly frustrated because of the lack of opportunity in those days or for a man like him. But a brilliant, articulate, had a sense of business that he
mm-hmm.
could never quite manifest. He had a sense of literature that he could never quite find a way to do that. You know, it was always obstacles to his... And
mm-hmm.
then he had 6 children to support.
You know, when you think about that, I mean, that is a real incredible story.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about the damage that racism does, because what you're talking about is that the parable of race in America
yeah.
and all over the world. My father was not the beneficiary of an extensive education either. He started, in fact, working at the age of 5, producing coal with his family,
mm-hmm.
burning wood to make coal. And, you know, throughout his life took so many different turns. He was a taxi driver, which is why I have a
yes.
great love for cab drivers.
Right, you certainly do. And they're listening, too.
My mother and my father ended up being business people,
mm-hmm.
But extraordinarily intelligent, extraordinarily gifted, extraordinarily brilliant beyond the way life prepared them, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a constant theme, you know, like your father. When you say he was a defeated man, he was a man who was put in an impossible
mm-hmm.
position. And I don't know if he was defeated because he survived.
Well, he raised 6 wonderful children.
Yeah. Yeah.
He educated them
yeah.
in his way.
Yes.
And we're not all college educated, but we're certainly educated.
Yes.
And functional. And I just want to make this point with you, Utrecht, that I want to talk about the women that these men were married to. For example, In that situation, you'd think the mother would go out to work. My mother stayed home because she had six children to raise, and that was primary. And whatever we didn't have, I got the message that she loved us and he loved us too.
Yep.
And even though it wasn't expressed in all the ways, like Hallmark cards, you know, my sense of it was I was protected and I was loved, and that there was a sacrifice being made. For example, my mother, being home was hard for her because she had worked her whole life. And they got married late, too. She was like 27. In those days, that was late.
Yeah.
And her first child at 28, that's pretty late back then. And but she had a lot of skills, you know, business skills. But she was home with us, so she would make clothes and sell them. And she'd cook pies and sell them. She would clean houses. She would do other people's laundry. Whatever was needed, she would do it. But she took the brunt of his frustration with his life.
Yeah.
And she stood tall. And she said to us, always respect your father. I mean, he would be outrageous sometimes. She never let on anything.
That's a really incredible story, because it's oppression on top of oppression, and people having to summon up the very best of who they are in order to meet the demand of the day. I mean, it couldn't possibly have been an easy task.
And the demand of the day was never about her.
That's it. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
that's what we all have, I think. Our parents, they waged serious revolutions.
Yes.
And it wasn't with guns and running out there screaming. It was about producing the best individuals, human beings, that they possibly could, as not just a legacy, but also as a critical link in the continuum, you know, of what it means. That's their statement in life, was to produce better than who they were, and you know, some of us fell off. We fell down on the job in terms of nurturing and creating great families, the family structure, and maintaining great families by making the family unit a serious statement in our lives, you know. And we've gotten into adopting some of the most self-destructive messages about what it is we ought to desire and what it is we ought to yearn for, how it is we ought to pattern our lives. And that's why at a very early age, I think this is what imbued me with the spirit. Even within my family, I'm a kind of, my family is they're not, you know, people who are rah-rah out there. But I was like that early on in life. And my whole thing was, I don't care what people are thinking. It doesn't matter to me what people are seeing. Yeah, long before I came on the earth, they were talking. Long after I'm gone, they'll continue to say. In the meantime, I'm interested in being good enough and constantly improving so that the people who come into my realm and the people in whose realm I function, that it would be at least a beneficial experience, you know, that we can contribute meaningfully to each other.
Clearly they've awakened something in you. That kind of rearing that you describe, and we could get critical too about parts of it, but we choose not to. The same here with my background. I could get really critical about what didn't happen.
Yeah.
And maybe I did that when I was younger. But now I have such an appreciation for the rigorous discipline, the manners.
That's
example.
A big thing still with me. Manners is
manners.
A big thing. I hate rude people.
Yeah.
I hate it. I hate rudeness.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And, you know, sending notes when someone gives you a gift. We had to sit down and write a note. Even if it's just one word, my mother used to say, thank you. It goes a long way. And when I got older, someone else used to say, gratitude is riches. when you appreciate what you have, you make room for more. That was a clear message when I was younger. And yes, sir. No, sir. And that was enforced in my home. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
No, ma'am. And neither parent allowed disrespect of the other.
Mm-hmm.
So if my mother called you and went, what? My father heard that, he was on the case.
You'll have a high calcium diet
because
you'll be swallowing your teeth.
And what were did you have like favorite expressions like, they would say, they never did it, but they would say things like, I bet I'll slap you into the middle of next week. Or my mother used to say, Marjorie, I'm going to slap the soup out of you.
My mother would stand, she had this red belt in the kitchen.
Uh-huh.
It was a red plastic red belt near the stove.
Mm-hmm.
Never forget. And, you know, you get your comeuppance. And then she'd stand in the doorway and say, pass here, like you're stupid.
Get that belt.
Please, give me a break. And then, you know, we do the big fake out. We'd act like, well, and then zip right past her. Pass here. I said to pass here. Oh, no.
I'm not going there.
Not going there.
We used to hide under the sink. running from my father. Mom, hide me. And we'd be fine. I'd get under the sink. She'd say, no, you go, it's with your father. Business with your father. Because he kind of settled all the...
But, you know, I think about what it must be like because, you know, I'm not married.
Mm-hmm.
And, but still, I think that... Life is as a partner with somebody. What do you bring to the table? You know, I remembered attending a wedding. And I'm sitting there, and it occurred to me, I'm looking at two people up at the altar. And I said to myself, gee, how is it possible that you have half a person up there? You have two people and half a person. How is that even possible?
Mm-hmm.
And that is because people come to this whole thing, life, really, so unfulfilled. And we don't know who we are. We don't know what really is at the core of us. What are our absolutes in terms of non-negotiable items?
Mm-hmm.
What is it that I would rather die or eat nails than do? Or B, we don't necessarily follow particular codes. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And some people say, well, this is the talk of conservative people and whatnot. I don't even bother with all that. I think there's value in civility, value in manners, value in consideration for others, value in being selfless.
Yeah.
Value in being of service. I think there's great value in that. Value in humility.
Mm-hmm.
Value in really trying to be the best person that you can be, because you can deliver an even greater service. And that's what I think great people have in common. You know, the people we admire. The whole notion of you attain the best profile of yourself.